Into the Mystic author Christopher Hill is here. We're talking about, well, the music of the 1960s, and we were about to launch into a discussion about the British invasion, and just the question popped into my mind, what would have happened to American rock and roll had there been no British invasion? Chris?
Well, I think it would have not it would have gradually lost a lot of its original inspiration. When you think of guys from the 50s like Little Richard and Chuck Berry and Elvis Presley, originally their music was full of this ecstatic kind of energy that they derived from African-American traditions, especially the Black Church. What happened is that that music found its way over to England, and it was largely brought over to England by merchant sailors and seamen who would travel to the United States and bring back records from the USA. What the British found in it that they kind of revived for us and brought back was the feeling of freedom that was in the music, which meant something very different to British people, because they were living in a society that was in some ways very different from our own, and they had a lot of class barriers and a lot of social structures that kept people sort of chained into where and when they had been born and in what part of the country and what sort of accents they spoke with and things like that. And what the British heard in this American music, the thing they derived from it was the idea that there's an enormous amount of freedom available to people that in America had a brief, people got a sense of that in America briefly in the 1950s. But what the British brought back was the feeling that this sense of freedom and empowerment and a sort of new energy in their whole approach to life and the possibilities of living it in their society, that they absorbed and found very attractive and exported it back to the USA, where people, when the original British rock bands started sort of washing up on American shores, you look at early Beatles clips and interviews and movies, and you find this suggestion that this was a lifestyle that did not necessarily have to be restricted to teenagers at their dance parties, but could be a whole approach to life. And that's how a lot of American young people at first, and then people across the whole social spectrum began to tune into and find a source of energy in it, which I think through all the changes of 60s music, I think that was one thing that persisted from the earliest days of the Beatles onto something like Sgt. Pepper's in their much later, more sophisticated work. You still find this idea of the whole game of life in the society that you're living in being a much more open one, and one that had much more room for spontaneity and joy and freedom. And I think this was the gift that the British brought back to us, that they had originally derived from American music, but that they sort of refined and developed into this whole sort of culture, which eventually became the cultural movement in the United States and worldwide. So I think that American music, without the inspiration that they got from these British bands, I don't think we would have had nearly as memorable an era with the concomitant social changes that went with it, the attitudes, the general attitudes towards the possibility of living a life.
Right. One of the interesting things, well, many interesting things that you write about in Into the Mystic is what was striking about the British musicians was that they were clearly boys, although not in an age when when young men in America already looked like men. The Beatles had appropriated this kind of this public school look.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, they look like public school boys. Did we lose Chris? Are you there, Chris? All right. We've lost Chris. We'll get him back. And just a reminder, coming up at the top of the hour, we're going to continue with this theme of the 60s. And Tobias Churton, who is a British scholar in esoteric movements, will be along. He's the author of Spiritual Meaning of the 60s. And we'll talk about the culture and the spiritual traditions that informed the 1960s and the music and so forth, the counterculture, as we call it. And right now we're trying to get a hold back in touch with Christopher Hill. He is a music critic and the author of Into the Mystic, The Visionary and Ecstatic Roots of the 1960s Rock and Roll. And I guess we have Christopher Hill back. So, Chris, we were talking about how the Beatles in particular, they looked like boys, not men necessarily, and they played these protagonists of what you call of these English stories. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, at that time, as I say in the book, in the United States, there was the sense that you went from being a child to very quickly becoming processed into your role as an adult in the world of adults, of adult life in American society. And there wasn't a sense that you had this brief sense in the 50s that American teenagers were feeling a little bit more empowered and as if there was a life available to them that they hadn't thought of before. But that was kind of, those embers were sort of dying at that time. And what happened with the British bands is that they came around to suggest that the territory between childhood and adulthood was much more extensive than people had previously thought was available to them in the United States. So that when the Beatles came over, they looked like schoolboys, sort of, and they didn't look like children, but they were clearly not adult males in the roles that Americans had been taught to envision for themselves. And this idea of a life that could be lived in this open space between the two was very refreshing. It was very electrifying and empowering for young American people to have these examples in front of them of sort of a new kind of lifestyle that could be lived.
You also write that they came ashore, waves of these lost boys washed up on American shores, and they came with a sensibility that seemed to come from Lewis Carroll by way of Oscar Wilde. And I remember, you know, we've all seen those news reels and film clips of the Beatles being interviewed when they first came to America, and how their comedic timing was so, it was brilliant, and they had all these wonderful quips. You know, one of my favorites, someone asked, "Mr. Lennon, how did you find America?" And he said, "I turned left at Greenland." Just, I don't know if they were rehearsed ad libs, where they got those lines from, but the I love that what you said, the sensibility that came from Lewis Carroll by way of Oscar Wilde. Just talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, there is a culture in the UK that that American children had been exposed to. A lot of American children were exposed to when they were quite young, and they were being read stories and seeing plays on television and things in the movies that suggested this very different kind of culture that was a little bit more playful, a little bit wittier. The Beatles, of course, were not formally well-educated people. They did not have the advantages of going on to university or anything like that. And yet they seem to have inherited this British tradition of sort of tongue-in-cheek humor, and it had a slight element of the fantastic to it, of fantasy to it, like you find in Lewis Carroll stories. Lewis Carroll was one of John Lennon's great favorites, and I think I say in the book at one point something like John Lennon said that Alice in Wonderland was everything to him when he was a boy. And so you find this tradition of British humor and British fantasy and British imagination that came in along with the music. It was part of the package of it.
Right, right. You also write here that Timothy Leary, it's a quote from Timothy Leary, he said the British are the original hippies. They'd been writing about the psychedelic experience for 300 years. Talk to me about that.
Well, there too, I think what Leary was referring to was this element of fantasy in the British imaginative life that that reminded, when it came to America, partly in the form of these rock and roll bands, but partly in the form of a whole British cultural influence that that became important in America at that time. It became very influential. The idea, once again, the idea that the boundaries of ordinary life were a little bit more elastic, you know, had some room for expansion, and had been expressed in this other culture for quite a long time. There's a tradition behind it. And I think that, you know, one of the things I say in the book to repeat myself a little bit, is that American children have been sort of primed for this from their childhoods on, and they recognized it when this British influence was sort of re-imported to the United States, so that they sensed that, in a way, people in Britain had always been tuned into this other frequency of thought and imagination that that was once again very liberating for American young people to encounter.
You also write that this music was being received with an urgent apocalyptic mood. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that there was this feeling in the 60s that, and maybe this was the beginning of something that we still feel today, but the idea that things were sort of coming to a head, and that Western society in particular was coming to sort of a culmination of whatever we had been heading towards before. And this is something I talked about in my chapter about California, the idea that we have reached one kind of limit and we're prepared for a leap to another one. And things seem to be, we often think of our own time as being particularly chaotic or unsettling, but things in a way felt much more unsettled in the 1960s than they do even now. And I think that the music, with its various messages of things changing, things gradually shifting on sort of a worldwide basis, was felt as sort of part of that whole phenomena, and also maybe part of the cause of it too at the same time.
The timing of the Beatles landing in America, just a few months in February of 64, just a few months after the assassination of Kennedy, how significant was that timing, that they almost served as a salve to heal America's wounds? Do you think that that just even added further to their success?
Well, I think there was definitely a connection there. I feel like in the what we now see is the very brief extent of the Kennedy administration, you know, less than one term, 1,000 days, as people say, had begun to do some of the work that the British invasion continued, in the sense of a gradual feeling of things opening up a little bit more and getting a little bit freer in our society in general. And I think that when the Beatles came along, it wasn't only that it gave us a distraction from the assassination of the president, but it seemed in a way to be carrying on the same kind of work. It seemed to say that some of the new sense of optimism and openness in this country could continue, that there were new sources we could draw on to sort of keep moving in that direction.
All right, we've got to take a time out, but there's a great quote here you have from Norman Mailer talking about Kennedy. He said he was a sheriff that the outlaws could respect. We'll take a quick time out, come back. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett. We'll get back to my conversation with Christopher Hill, the author of Into the Mystic, The Visionary and Ecstatic Roots of 1960s Rock and Roll. If you like what you hear tonight this morning and you want to find out more about what I do, you can go to my website, strangeplanet.ca. Everything is right there, strangeplanet.ca. And you can now hear me weekday afternoons, 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern, on the all-new Richard Serrett Show on News Talk Saga 960 AM. That's across the Greater Toronto Area, and you can stream it live on saga960am.ca. Saga, spelled S-A-U-G-A. Saga 960 AM. Or you can find it on Simple Radio or TuneIn. And you can listen to my weekly syndicated program, The Conspiracy Show, on AM 740 Zoomer Radio in Toronto. My podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited, drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Again, go to my website, strangeplanet.ca. It's all right there. All right, back to more of my conversation with Chris Hill on the music of the 60s when Coast to Coast AM returns. We're back with music critic Chris Hill, author of Into the Mystic. Chris, we were talking about the assassination of Kennedy, and I wanted to talk about the impact of that assassination on Bob Dylan. Because you write just in a few months after Kennedy's assassination, Dylan's on a road trip with his friends in early 64, and I think they're heading to Mardi Gras, New Orleans. And it's during this first trip that Dylan talks about or mentions the French poet we mentioned off the top of the program, and that's Arthur Rimbaud. And he said he no longer wanted to be a folk singer. Was that because of Kennedy's assassination?
Well, there was a connection there. At that point, Dylan was beginning to go through this transformation that has been talked about a lot over the years, between being a more topical folk singer, where he would specifically write his songs with an idea of addressing particular incidents or particular social injustices that that he saw. And at that time, it really was almost on the day of the assassination, I believe, that Dylan started writing a new song, which would eventually become his song, The Chimes of Freedom. And initially, it was written as a very specific response to the assassination, but eventually it grew into something that was addressed much more universally. And the idea that instead of looking at particular political situations and narratives that he had been paying attention to before, he was going to start dealing with more of an oppressed state of consciousness, much like William Blake had spoken about centuries before, which Blake referred to as the mind-forged manacles that we all wear. And Dylan became more and more interested in sort of the internal struggle for freedom and liberation that could take place within each individual. And I think that for him, the Kennedy assassination was, I can't say what Dylan's own ideas about conspiracies behind the assassination might have been, but to him it represented a reaction, a sort of negative reaction to new possibilities, as we've been talking about, for freedom and new options in life that somebody had been attempting to shut down via the assassination of the president. And for him, it became a very large metaphor that eventually sort of changed his whole approach to songwriting and his art, as we can see developing with the very next album he released after the assassination, which was full of songs that were much more full of sort of fantastic or irrational elements, dreamlike elements that he had not appeared to be much interested in before. And I think that for him, that was his response to a whole situation of consciousness rather than a particular political situation. And I think that it's pretty clear that he turned a corner right around that time.
All right, let's go to the phones. Are you good to take some calls, Chris?
Okay.
All right, let's go to the wild card line. Wayne is in Tacoma, Washington. Hello, Wayne. Welcome.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you very much, Sir Richard, for taking my call. Yes. Earlier on, you asked about Miracle. I don't know if we can talk about that or not. You tell me.
We'll stick to the subject at hand, if you don't mind, Wayne, talking about the music of the 60s.
Okay. Well, that is something that I have very profound memories of, because I grew up starting with Elvis Presley and Little Richard, and went on into about the mid-60s. Had a very profound realization at that time, because I was coming out of the Air Force, felt led to go into Christian service and outreach, and knew that I couldn't listen to rock and roll anymore because it was going to mess up my life in the Christian ministry. So your gentleman there said that it was a change of going from gospel church music into rock and roll, and I saw just the opposite coming for me, and I didn't want to go there. So just let me his comments on that.
Well, all right, Chris, did you want to add anything to that?
Sorry. Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Sure. I think that in a broad sense, I don't think we always look towards secular culture as if we are adherents to a particular faith tradition as giving us addressing necessarily those specific faith traditions. On the other hand, I do believe that that there was a legitimate spiritual impulse that you can feel in music from that era that was that has an element of spiritual sincerity about it in terms of looking for more bottom line realities than had perhaps been made available in popular music before then. And I think that I don't particularly see a reason why it's necessary to, if you enjoy one thing, if you enjoy the music, to necessarily feel like you have to cut that off from the rest of your spiritual life. In fact, that's in a way, that's the whole point of my book, is that there is, in a non-specific way, in a non-denominational way, there is, you can feel the spirit moving in this music. In a very powerful way sometimes.
All right, Wayne, thank you for the call. I did want to touch on California. You mentioned it earlier, and it is obviously a very important element in this whole, in the decade of the 60s, because, you know, what came out of California. And I think you, in the book, you talk about how from the very, you know, even the early 20th century, California was home to some interesting cults and sects, like the Rosicrucians. You had also gurus coming to California from the East.
Yes.
And it seems like also that teen culture, which was obviously this youth movement, an integral part of the 60s, also came out of the 60s, because they were the children of parents who grew up, you know, they were taking yoga in the 1940s and different things like that. Talk to me about that.
Well, I think that for the purposes of the story I'm telling in the book, California was kind of the England of America, in the sense that a lot of new energy and new ideas were coming out of that, of the West Coast at that time. And, you know, I give some reasons why I thought that was the case, having to do with sort of the big story of Western expansion across the United States. And how when people got to California, there was a kind of utopian feeling, like we had gone as far as we could, and here, if anywhere, we were going to build and embody that whatever new ideas for society that that we had. And there is just I keep returning to the idea of freedom, but there was much more of a feeling of freedom and possibility in California life. Now, that's changed over the years. And, you know, we may, California may no longer stand in that position vis-a-vis the rest of the United States. But at, in that particular era, there was a sense that California was also offering new options for lifestyle and consciousness and the ability to lead a different and perhaps richer kind of life than we had known before that point.
All right, let's go to the phones and let's see. Charles is in Asheville, North Carolina, on the first time caller line. Charles, welcome.
Yes, hello. Sir, I'm so glad to speak with you, and you do such a great job. You all you had been talking about the British invasion, and I just love that. So I've I've been living at this time, but I had an odd question that I want to ask your guest. And you all said something a minute ago about cults, a cult, and et cetera in California. And what I was reminded of was about the Rolling Stones being at the concert in Altamont, California. And I wondered
and we know how that ended. It ended badly.
Yes, and I wondered if your guest thinks that had much of a impact, and the tragedy of it, the horrible, the Hell's Angels was in there and all that, and it was the worst thing. And if he thinks that had much effect at that time and afterwards.
All right. What do you say about the Altamont concert, Chris?
Well, I think that the whole thing that happened at Altamont was a kind of symptom of darkness that was beginning to take over the hopes of the counterculture at that time. And I think that it was a lesson, to get back to all this talk about freedom that I've been talking about for the last couple of hours. I think that the idea that there might be some limit or some downside to this freedom that people felt, that there might be consequences that that had not been envisioned in the more utopian years briefly preceding Altamont, that that people finally came face to face with in situations like that. You know, that wasn't the only example of a sort of darkening of the 60s at that point. And I think that it was it was a time when people realized that there might be some other prices to be paid for the sort of freedom that they had been enjoying, the sort of utopian American freedom that that had been very exciting and appealing to people. But in the end, there were questions that they were going to have to deal with about violence and drugs and things like that, that events like Altamont did a lot to bring home to people.
All right, Charles, thank you for that. Just a last quick question, and since we're talking about the Bay Area, the Grateful Dead, of course, were involved. When we think of psychedelic music, we think of, and you point this out in the book, we think of feedback and distortion and phasing and loop tape and backward masking and all of that. But we hear none of that, really, with the Grateful Dead. They sound at times like a bluegrass band. So in what way, what made the Grateful Dead psychedelic? And we just have a couple minutes here.
That's a good question. What made the Grateful Dead psychedelic was not so much in, you listen to an album like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which is often held to be sort of the finest example or the most pure example of psychedelic music, and you realize that you don't hear anything like that in the music of the Grateful Dead. And I think, and this may be sort of a biased reaction, but I think that the Grateful Dead relied much more on purely musical technique to achieve what you might call the psychedelic effect. It was all in the playing and the interaction of the instruments, and they're very, at least in the beginning, they're very sensitive ability to sense the state that their audience was in and pick up on it and bring them along with it through their playing. It didn't have to come through overdubbing of strings or particular studio effects, a high level of processing of the music as you hear in Sgt. Pepper's. And I think that, the Dead were, and probably this was, as you mentioned, probably it did come out of their origins as a folk band. As a sort of...
All right. Unfortunately, Chris, we have to leave it there, I'm afraid. We are sadly out of time. We'll have to do this again. There's so much to cover. Into the Mystic, Christopher Hill, thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you very much. Appreciate being on your show.
And Tobias Churton is coming up next, and we'll keep this topic going, the spiritual meaning of the 60s, when Coast to Coast AM continues.